Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section.
Hello, my name is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you Psalm 36, Tehillim Lamed Vav. Lamnatzeach le'eved Adonai le'David, for the maestro, by a servant of the Lord, by David. David identifies himself as the Lord's servant at the end of the previous psalm. So there seems to be a clear flow from that Tehillah Lamed He, to this one. By the way, note the interesting double use of the Lameds, Le'eved Adonai and Le'David, which means that these two prepositions or prepositional phrases are both explaining the same thing, i.e., the origin of the song. This double use of prepositions is called apposition, not apposition with an O, but apposition with an A, and is a technique used a few times in this psalm. And by recognizing this syntactic structure, this technique, it becomes a little bit easier to translate the psalm, as we will see. Anyway, getting back to the psalm. Ne'um pesha l'rasha bekerev libi ein pachad Elohim l'neged einav. This is a very challenging verse to translate, but I think that if we put the prepositional phrase bekerev libi at the beginning of the sentence, as does Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and other commentators, it reads like this. In my mind, bekerev libi is the ne'um pesha, the speech of rebellion, or of the rebellion, la rasha, to the wicked, which is that there is no fear of God against his eyes. Ein pachad Elohim l'neged einav. That means to say that the wicked talks himself into thinking that there is nothing to fear. Obviously, the metaphor against his eyes is similar to Freud's definition of the superego, which is this sense of a moral compass or of a necessary moral or ethical code, which keeps negative desires from becoming negative actions. And without it, without this Yirat Elokim Negede Nav, then the id and the ego are essentially free to roam unrestrained. The idea of Pachad Elohim, which is also known as Yirat Elohim, while it may refer to fear of God himself, which is how I just translated it above, although you'll see that I'm about to retranslate it, Yirat Elohim and Pachad Elohim could also mean that one is guided by moral and societal norms, ethical norms. So when Avram says to Avimelech, after Avram says that Sarah is his sister, and then Avimelech takes Sarah as a, attempts to become to take her as a wife. So Avram says, and Avimelech says, "How come you did this terrible thing? If you just told me she was your wife, I wouldn't have tried to take her." So Avram comes back and says, "No. Ki amarti rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh. I said to myself that there is no Yirat Elohim in this place," and therefore he had to hide his wife's identity. Avram is not referring to Avimelech's theology. He's not saying that there is no fear of one God or the God in this place that you live. What Avram means is that there are no moral compunctions in this place, and that they would as soon kill a man and take his wife, as look at him if they so desired. The idea here is that Elohim doesn't mean God so much, but it means like judges or the right, just way. So one fears the right way. And here too, the problem with the wicked may not be so much that there's a religious deficiency, ein pachad Elohim l'neged einav, but there's a moral ethical deficiency, and therefore that essentially allows him to commit all kinds of sins. And therefore, I'd like to retranslate the verse and say, he has no moral or ethical compass to guide him. Now, the word pesha in this verse, rebellion, is the one who actually makes the speech to this wicked person, ne'um pesha, the speech of the rebellion. Rebellion, therefore, is a personification of the sinner's own tendency to rebel and to do evil. But the author essentially is asking us to treat rebellion as if it is an external character. And we often refer to this idea as an evil inclination or the Yetzer Hara. And some see it actually as a real external force to do evil. I am personally more comfortable with a psychological approach. That is, the evil really is part of us, but to clarify it, we make it this sort of external power of its own. Nonetheless, the author is really asking us to treat this thing as if it had a will of its own. Therefore, in the next pasuk, ki hechalik elav beinav limtso avano lisno, we translate, indeed it, the pesha, the personification of rebellion, slipped him up or tripped him up in the vernacular, that is him, the evil person, the person who will do the sins, by way of his eyes, in order that he find sin, limtso avano, or find his sin, in order to cause hatred. Note, once again, we have an apposition of the two lamids, of the two prepositions, as I mentioned in the introduction. That means that both prepositions modify the word to slip or to trip up, i.e. he caused him to slip in order to have his sin found, and he caused him to slip in order to create hatred. Hatred probably perhaps meaning that the person will be hated because of his sins, or perhaps God is the subject of these two prepositional phrases, and we should translate God, he, the personification of rebellion, slipped him up in order that God will find his sin in him, in order that God will, so to speak, find a reason to hate him. But lest we lose ourselves in a devil made me do it attitude, which almost absolves the sinner from his sins, because, you know, what was he going to do? This evil, rebellious spirit caused him to commit the sins. The author points out that the sinner himself is really at fault. Divrei piv aven umirma chadal lehaskil lehetiv. The words of his, i.e. the sinner's mouth, are evil and deceitful. He prevents himself from wising up. He prevents himself from doing better. Note again the appositional lamids, lehaskil lehetiv. And now, so what that's saying is that the sinner is the one who lies. He's the one who prevents himself from getting smarter. Now, it's still possible to translate this sentence as if the evil inclination is the subject. That is, the evil inclination is the one who is speaking evil in the heart of one, the one who will be seduced. However, the author really drives home the point in the next verse that it is the sinner who is committing the sin and no one else is to blame. Aven yachshov al mishkavo yitzatzev al derech lo tov ra lo yimas. He plans evil while on his bed. The sense is that when his thoughts wander at night, like many of ours do, he lets them wander into trouble. He positions himself on a no good road, al derech lo tov. He does not reject badness, lo yimas, ra lo yimas, or more literally, he does not find badness disgusting. All this tells us that the fault is on the sinner, who not only does not reject the inner voice, but he courts it. He walks in its path, he revels in its thoughts, and he refuses to push them away in disgust when these thoughts intrude on his thinking. Now, where does all this philosophizing on evil come from? That is, what is the point of our psalm? What is David trying to say? And how does it relate to what's going to come in the next verse and for the rest of the psalm, which is really a praise of God's purity and righteousness? That is, why is David going into this idea of what causes sin? So I think it may be just that. That is, after spending, as I pointed out yesterday, the greater part of the previous psalm, Psalm 25, trashing the enemy and wishing on the enemy destruction and they get their just punishments, David is now explaining or exploring where does all this evil come from? What makes an evil person evil? So he's explained that, and now what David will do, if I'm interpreting the flow and intent correctly of this very difficult psalm, David is now telling us why he, the servant of the Lord, does not fall into the same traps as the sinner does, who is allowed to see things or to be seduced with his eyes into sin. Adonai b'hashamayim chasdecha emunatecha ad shechakim. O Lord, your chesed, your kind and true deeds, is in the heavens. Your reliability is up to the skies. Note that in the skies is b'hashamayim, which is usually, in almost every case, shortened to bashamayim, so the hay disappears. But here, the definite article of the hay is not absorbed into the preposition ba, so we get b'hashamayim. Anyway, back to the verse. Tzidkatcha keharei el, mishpatecha tehom rabah, adam uvehema toshia Adonai. Your righteousness goes as high as the highest mountains. Your justice goes as deep as the great abyss, the great deep. You save both man and beast. Now, take it at face value. These two verses could be read simply as a hymn to God's greatness. But if we assume that it's a continuation of the previous section of why the evil become evil, and in fact a contrast to that section, then the author is telling us that the greatness of God, the kind and true works that he does, his dependability, his righteousness, is all very easy to see just by lifting one's eyes to the heavens. Moreover, God's justice is so visible because it is fills the totality of a vertical axis from the watery deep down below to the highest mountain up above. Note, by the way, that the word El in Harare El, the word El really doesn't mean God here, and very often it doesn't mean God when it comes after a noun. What it means here is a superlative, meaning the greatest of mountains or the tallest of mountains. And this use of the word El or Elohim after a noun is also the likely translation in the book of Yonah. When Nineveh is called as such, V'Nineveh Hayitai, it was Ir Gdola Le'Elohim, which probably means it was a super big city, which explains the next words, that it took 3 days to travel through it. Similar is the translation of Ruach Elohim in the first chapter of Genesis, which probably means a super powerful wind, a hurricane force wind, was agitating the waters rather than trying to translate Ruach Elohim as the Spirit of God. Secondly, kind of focusing in on how I did my translation, I do not believe that his justice is like a great mountain or like the abyss, because, well, that's not really much of a compliment to say that God's justice is like the abyss. I think we're dealing with this vertical area from the mountains to the deep. In all of those places, there, back, and in between, one can see God's greatness, his justice and his righteousness. And now we get back to the meaning of the psalm. David is saying is that all you have to do is look around. All you have to do is look. And that should really be enough to see God's greatness, which counteracts the seductive sights of the evil inclinations, this personification of rebellion that was putting these seductions in front of one's eyes. Remember, it was saying that through putting these things in front of their eyes, this rebellion was able to seduce the evildoer. So what David's saying is, there's a counteraction. There's a remedy for that. Just look around from the heavens to the earth, and everywhere you look, you could see the greatness of God, and that should be enough to counteract any seductive thoughts which are put in front of your quote-unquote eyes, any seductions which affect your moral compass. That is, if you want to straighten the moral compass, just look at the heavens and the earth and see God. And now in the next verse, I think what the psalm does is, instead of giving us the entire heavens, the entire earth, it focuses on a very specific place where God can be found and where God's greatness can be found, so to speak, and where one could appreciate his presence and his effect in this world. And therefore, we can know and be protected against evil. And we can know that evil must be avoided, and we can be protected against it. That place is, of course, the Holy Temple, the Beit HaMikdash. And while it is not mentioned explicitly in the next few verses, there are in the next few verses a series of allusions to the Beit HaMikdash, to the Holy Temple. I should mention, by the way, that many of the commentators see in the next verses allusions or descriptions of the world to come, the Olam Haba. And without question, the Temple of God is connected to this utopian and messianic Olam Haba, this world of the future. However, I think for the purpose of what David is trying to do in this psalm, which is to show us where we can look to get a straightforward moral compass. Therefore, I think that the instruction is much more practical and much more visible. And therefore, I think he's focusing on the temple, to look to the temple rather than looking to a potential future world. That is, he's saying, look to the temple, look to the sacrifices, look to the beauty of God's deeds and the way he asks us to interact with him. And that should prevent your eyes from being seduced by this quote unquote rebellious desire. Mayakar chastecha Elohim, uvnei Adam, which is a rhetorical question, of course. How precious is your chesed, your just deeds, O God, that uvnei Adam, I think means that people, can take shelter in the shadow of your cloak. Vetzel Knafecha, and I'm following the Rambam, Maimonides, in translating Knafecha as your cloak and not your wings. Your wings brings to mind kind of an angelic imagery with the wings and the angel flying around, and it's a very nice imagery, but it's certainly also very popular in Christian art. However, I think the image is better served of a child hiding under the corners, the knafayim of a cloak, of a talit, so to speak, and is much more evocative of the kind of parent-child relationship and protection that David is shooting for here. So what David is saying is the fact that you gave us a place to find shelter in is the most obvious realization of the loving kindness, the chesed of your deeds. The fact that you allowed us to build a temple where we can come and worship to you in a unified way, that is your chesed, your loving kindness to us. And notice the words chasa in this pasuk, to take shelter, are often used by the sukkah, or the temple of God. But the next verse has an even more obvious allusion to the holy temple. Yirviyun mideshen beitecha, that is the people who come to shelter in your place. They feast from the luxuries of your house, they being the people who come to the Beit HaMikdash. And your house, of course, is the temple here, beitecha. But even more powerful allusion is the word deshen, which means not so much luxuries, but deshen were the fatty ashes that were left over on the altar following the sacrifices to God. V'nachal adanecha tashkem, and you feed them with your refreshing stream. Note the word adanecha, Eden, is like the Garden of Eden, which is also a reference to the temple, or also to the world to come. But the stream may be a reference to the oil or wine sacraments which were poured on the altar. And now we have a final verse describing the power of God's temple. Ki imcha mekor chayim beorcha nir'eh or, because with you is the source of life, which may be a reference to the mayim chayim, the flowing live waters, which were used in many processes of purification. In your light, beorcha, we will see light nir'eh or. And here I think is a clear reference to the candelabras, the menorot, or the ner tamid, the eternal light that was maintained in the temple, and that by focusing on the spiritual light, one will see the ultimate light, which now, I agree, seems to be the eternal light of messianic world, of messianic salvation. This eternal light is spoken of very often in the book of Isaiah and in other biblical books, as well as in rabbinic writings and Second Temple writings as well. Finally, now that the thesis is stated, and let's review the thesis. A, the first few verses, evildoers allow themselves to be steered astray. They allow themselves to be seduced by what their eyes can see into committing sins. And two, the next few verses, the righteous keep their eyes on the wonders of God, from the heavens to the earth, to the deep, and to his holy temple, and therefore, by keeping their eyes focused on God, they avoid evil. So now that we've established the thesis, David now prays that God helps him to keep to the right course, because I think what he's saying is, it's not so simple simply to look all over the world and so immediately and overpoweringly see God's good deeds, and therefore not see the potential evil that one can be seduced to doing. He's saying that without God's help, regardless of how many wonderful things they look at, one can fall into the trap of being seduced by what's put in front of one's eyes. And therefore, we have a prayer to God now. Rather than just an abstract thesis, we have a prayer to God. Lean your kind deeds, or bring your kind deeds, your charity, to those who know you, and your righteousness, that are those willing to recognize you, make it easy for them to see your kind deeds, and make it easy for them to see your righteousness, make it very visible to the Yishrei Lev, to the straight of heart. The sense is, let them see how you do good for good people, since this will support them in their recognition of you. Al tivo'eyu regel gava v'yad rishaim al tinideini. Do not let the arrogant foot come my way, and don't let the hand of the wicked brush me away. Again, the sense is that if I do all these good things, but I still get trampled on and get brushed away, it's hard to affirm, to state with confidence that your goodness can be detected 360, 24/7, that is all over the world every day. As the author says, essentially it needs to be recognized in order to keep people from being seduced. What is really needed is to be able to say as follows, the final verse. Sham, Naflu Paale Aven Dochu Velo Yochlu Lakum. There, perhaps in the temple, or perhaps the author is saying, look there. I want to be able to say, look there. Paale Aven Naflu. Naflu Paale Aven. The doers of evil have fallen. They have been pushed aside and are unable to get up. And with God's help, and a clear and good focus on our part to recognize God's wonders all over the world, evil is avoided and goodness is chosen.